Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, it's Alejandro. And the kind gentleman who introduced me there, Bob Dean, I got to see him the other day because Richard Dolan was doing a talk in town. It was a great talk, and it was a packed house. There was something like probably 150 people there. Awesome, and it's at this place called the Advanced Technology Institute or something, which is pretty cool. Great room and everything. So great. A lot of cool people there, including Bob Dean, who you just heard right there. An interesting fella and a friend of ours who lives not too far away in Ahwatukee, a wonderful town to say the name of, Ahwatukee. So it was wonderful to see everybody again. And Phoenix MUFON always does a great job. We have a great MUFON group here. But unfortunately, I have more bad news. And I hate having to bring the bad news to you, although you might know this already because there's been emails all over. We've had it all over our Facebook and everything. But unfortunately, just yesterday afternoon, Bud Hopkins, the famous alien abduction researcher, passed away. So we have a bio on our website. There's some bios all over the place that you can check out. But our website, we've got one, and we've got links to others, and so you can check out. I noticed there's a lot of people posting YouTube videos that they've had recently. And in fact, we're going to put one together because we found some footage that we have that I don't think anybody's seen before. So we're going to put those up. So I think it's going to be Bud Hopkins month for the next month, remembering all of his work. And he really was a pioneer. He wasn't the first alien abduction researcher, but he was the first to really bring it to the public as an artist. Now, at first, he wasn't doing regressions. I mean, he was just doing the investigation and writing about it. He got a lot of the people, though, that do regressions these days into it. Dr. David Jacobs, Von Smith, wrote something about him, said he was instrumental in getting her involved with that. And, of course, we've had her on the show. And also John Mack, which was really cool because John Mack, you know, was one of the most esteemed people in the field to investigate abductions. Whitley Strieber also. He helped Whitley Strieber with his encounters and really helped facilitate that happen. So he was a big part of the whole alien abduction phenomena, researching it and getting it going. He has a website, The Intruders Foundation, which is a nonprofit that he started to help out alien abductees and to also educate the public on that. So, of course, there's a lot going on with Bud Hopkins that you'll be able to check out. And you know, our hearts go out to him and his friends, Leslie Keen, Peter Robbins, were very close to him for many years. And I know that this is probably very difficult for them. So go check out the website. Go to the Intruders Foundation and go, you know, send them your condolences and let them know that you care. Other things going on. We're going to have today a guest who is actually my very first guest of UFO Think Tank Radio. My friend, physicist Claude Swanson, he got his degrees at MIT and at, now I forget the other school, I think it was Penn State, I'll have to look it up, I'll look it up for you guys, but anyway, he's worked at the Brookhaven Labs, he worked on a lot of government projects for defense and theoretical physics, so trying to figure out, you know, kind of the cutting edge stuff, and he's still doing that. However, he noticed that the paranormal, when he looked into it, was not only real, he noticed there was a lot of scientific investigation into various parts of the paranormal. So he thought, if this is something really going on, and physics is supposed to explain all of everything that goes on, he's really tackled with theoretical ideas on how to explain the paranormal through physics. So, you know, you've all heard of quantum physics, which is kind of the study of the smallest particles, but going even further than that and what's at the basis of everything. So this is going to be a very interesting talk because we're going to talk about all of that and how it relates to UFO technology and some of the things that we see in the UFO field as well. So that's what's going on here on the show. One thing I do want to mention, just to plug myself, but to thank you all, first of all, thank not just you all, but all of the people that we interview. You know, some people say, why do you have that person on and why do you have this person on? But I think that we all need to be happy that there are people looking into the paranormal, that you all are brave enough to come and to listen, but also that all of these people, even if you don't agree with them, there's plenty of people that I like and I have colleagues and I don't believe exactly what they believe, but I think it's wonderful that they've been brave enough to put all the time and the effort into actually researching the paranormal. So that's why we have such a wide range of guests here, and I think we all need to appreciate that. And the reason I bring that up is because I kind of feel I'm excited about this new project, essentially blogging for the Huffington Post, because it's conventional media and it's exciting because they're posting my stuff on the paranormal up there in conventional media. And I feel like I can help champion some of the work that all of these people do. And if you're interested in this stuff, you know, go check out my blog and comment on there and show people in the conventional media that there are a lot of people out here that take this stuff very seriously. And I hope to make arguments up there because the blogs are opinion. And my opinion is that a lot of this stuff should be taken seriously. So I'm trying to express that. But I'm real excited about that. So that's something to go check out. But without further ado, to get into it, because I know Jason's got a lot of cool stuff, let's check out the UFO news. Jason is here to give it to us. You looked scared for a minute. You don't have any good stuff?
I always have good stuff.
I know.
But don't hype it up too much.
Okay.
I don't want to let anyone down.
Oh, you always deliver, buddy.
Thank you, sir. Greetings, Alejandro, and hello, everyone. Hello to all of our wonderful listeners and viewers out there. Let's get into your UFO news brief for Monday, August 22nd, 2011. Researchers at Pennsylvania State University recently proposed a theory that suggests if extraterrestrials detected changes in Earth's atmosphere due to increased greenhouse gas emissions, they might attack humans to protect other civilizations from humanity's destructive actions. The 33-page study, published in the journal Acta Astronautica, is titled, Would Contact with Extraterrestrials Benefit or Harm Humanity? A Scenario Analysis. And it evaluates the potential risks of a hostile extraterrestrial encounter. Space.com explains the most popular scenario presented in the paper, stating, an extraterrestrial civilization might notice our planet by detecting changes in the spectral signature of Earth, the light radiated by our planet and atmosphere, caused by greenhouse gas emissions, and they might frown upon our behavior. According to the International Business Times, media reports about this new study frightened some of the general public with headlines like, NASA report, aliens may destroy humanity to protect other civilizations, and NASA, aliens may destroy humanity over greenhouse gases. NASA was forced to quickly respond, clarifying that while one of the paper's authors, postdoctoral student Sean Domagoll Goldman, works at NASA headquarters, NASA was in no way involved with the study. NASA posted multiple messages on Twitter addressing the issue with statements like, yes, Drudge Report and Guardian News are mistaken about alien report. It's not NASA research. And again, claims we released a study about aliens are not true. Going even further to clear up the confusion, NASA posted a link to Domagoll Goldman's blog where he too addressed the confusion, stating, so here's the thing. This isn't a NASA report. It's not work funded by NASA, nor is it work supported by NASA in other ways. It was just a fun paper written by a few friends, one of whom who happens to have a NASA affiliation.
Yeah. It's sad they get it wrong because they didn't have to. Even just saying that this is a student or these are students and to write about some of this speculation is still enough of a story. I mean, it's an interesting concept.
It certainly is. You know, that there are many ways the journalists could have done this. And, you know, if you want to hype it up a bit, you can still mention NASA. But,
yeah,
you know, you need to clarify that it's a NASA researcher.
Mm-hmm.
Not NASA is saying this.
And, you know, it's a theory that someone like Stanton Friedman and some of these others, even some of the SETI scientists, have been pushing for a while. I remember the conference in Russia, the SETI conference, they were talking about it. And the whole idea about how we are just kind of crazy, we're screwing stuff up on our planet. So they would probably just kind of segregate us, watch us, contain us, and see how things go. But I would think that this isn't something new to them. If there really are a lot of civilizations out there, a ton of them, they probably ran across other civilizations at the point that we're at, or they once themselves were at this point. So it's nothing too new, although I would see how they would be interested in checking it out, you know.
Oh, for sure.
The science class, let's go look at a civilization at this point. Let's go look at a civilization at this point.
Right.
Fly around and take their notes. Those guys are funny.
That's what they did on Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly.
They flew around and watched people. They didn't, well, they sometimes interfered, but they weren't supposed to.
They tried not to, but sometimes, you know, Captain Kirk's, his passion, he would fall so deeply in love with a beautiful alien woman that he just couldn't help himself.
Well, that goes without saying.
Yeah.
I completely
what
understand.
Can you do?
But Alejandro, you know that this really rubs me the wrong way. I have a strong distaste for this theme of pushing the hostile extraterrestrial concept on people. That is all we hear about lately. All the television shows, all the specials they're putting on, the Science Channel,
yeah.
Discovery. It's all about alien attacks. All the movies.
But
pushing this negative image and scaring people about extraterrestrial life.
But it always comes back to economics. We're a capitalist country. It's all about money. It's just like the news is all about blood and gore. One rule of thumb in the news has always been, if it bleeds, it leads. And sure enough, that's what we see all the time. And so then it translates over to UFOs, over to every subject, scare people, sharks attack, bears maul, you know, everything, you know, puppies bite, you know. So it's just all this scare stuff because they feel it makes some money off of it, yep. It just makes money, 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 and that's all they care about. So
I'm glad you provided me with a segue to the next story.
Cool.
And that is, one of the leading U.S. economists says that an alien invasion could fix the troubled economy.
There we go.
Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist and Nobel Prize winner, presented this idea on the CNN show GPS, hosted by Fareed Zakaria. Krugman stated, if we discovered the space aliens were planning to attack and we needed a massive buildup to encounter this space alien threat, and inflation and budget deficits took secondary place to that, this slump would be over in 18 months. He credited the idea to an episode of The Twilight Zone, where scientists fake an alien invasion to achieve world peace. But as he explained, this time, we need it in order to get some fiscal stimulus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I was saying, it's already happening. All of these alien movies, alien attack movies, are getting lots of viewers, except for Cowboys and Aliens, I guess. Didn't too good, but Paul's doing good on DVD, some of these others. So it's working. It's making some money.
Yeah, some of them work. Yeah, a lot of these movies actually do well, but yeah, like you said, Cowboys and Aliens, and then like Mars Needs Mom.
Yeah, that didn't
do too
good either.
Biggest disappointments, and yeah. So.
But the Smurfs, they got to be alien. You know, they're little blue guys. They can. I'm gonna count them as aliens.
I haven't seen too many little blue guys here, so they must be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to get back, at least the story about the them trying to contain us or destroying us because we're destroying the planet. I think that's closer, at least, to this whole idea I have that a lot of them are at least indifferent to us. I mean that they are kind of like we would be with animals. We struggle with what should we do. Some of these animals are going out of control. Do we need to contain them? You know, same kind of thing. Some may be like, you know, they're kind of pests, so what do we do with this whole thing? As opposed to just, it makes more sense than I think coming and destroying just for the hell of it.
Right. But movies don't have to make sense, Alejandro.
Yeah, that's true.
No. Well, in other news, the UK National Archives released another batch of UFO files a couple weeks ago, and we talked about that, which marked the eighth batch of the formerly classified documents to be released to the public. These latest files, like previous released files, indicate the government's lack of interest in investigating UFO sighting reports. At least that was the perception the Ministry of Defense was trying to create. Nick Pope, who is the desk officer in charge of the MOD's UFO files, recently told the Huffington Post, what's abundantly clear from these files is that while in public we were desperately pushing the line that this was of no defense interest, but he goes on to state, we were telling the public, we're not interested. This is all nonsense. but in reality, we are desperately chasing our tails and following this up in great detail. Pope divulged an insider's look at the government's game of misleading people. He revealed one tactic used was to downplay UFO reports by referring to witnesses as UFO buffs or UFO spotters to make them sound less credible. They additionally used terms like little green men in reports to make the sightings seem silly, which would hopefully reduce the chance of the media picking up the story. When Pope was with the MOD, he too was required to go along with the policy of deception. He told the Huffington Post, "I believe in open government and freedom of information. I believe that the UFO phenomenon does raise important defense, national security, and air safety issues. And if I helped kill any initiative on that, I'm deeply sorry."
Mm-hmm. I spoke with Lee Spiegel, who wrote the Huffington Post story, and it was really funny because he helped organize the UN thing. We've had Antonio on, talked about that. Antonio's written about it in our magazine. And Lee Spiegel was the main kind of organizer putting all of that together. And he was shocked when he saw in the last batch how the UK really was trying to stifle his whole effort there with Sir Gary from Eric Gary from Grenada, who was a real sponsor of it. So it's kind of funny that he was referred to in these files and stuff, and then he speaks with Nick Pope, and Nick Pope apologizes for all of that. Although he said Nick Pope did tell him, "Even though I apologize, you can't really blame me because I was only a teenager when all of this happened." So, but of course, the stuff in the 90s, he can't apologize for because some of the files we even talked about and we have on our website, such as during the Ralph Noyes era, he was the person who wrote those letters.
Right.
We actually confirmed with him recently that he was one of those guys who wrote one of those letters saying, "Oh, you know, don't worry about it."
Yeah. Well, we have much more about that on our website. And our video producer just put together a video on this. And you appear on the video, Alejandro.
Me?
You do.
Yes.
And you look like crap, but no, I'm kidding. You look fantastic. It's a fun video. So we have that.
Because I didn't have my new glasses.
I know, new glasses. So we'll have to reshoot the video. But
yeah.
The video's there. We've got articles there. So check that out on openminds.tv. And then there was a UFO that appeared on live TV.
Whoa.
Maybe. Viewers of Channel 4 News in London were surprised on August 16th when they observed a UFO zooming through the sky in the background during an interview with British politician Tom Watson. According to the Metro, viewers called the television station to report the strange object that appeared at the top of the screen before darting in a flash. The UFO is only visible for a couple of seconds, and it is difficult to make out any physical details of the object. An airplane or helicopter have been suggested as possibilities, but the movement demonstrated by the UFO in the video makes these explanations seem unlikely. A seagull or another bird gliding through the London sky could be the identity of the object in question, but that is speculation on my part and others. The UFO remains unidentified and will likely remain so. One factor that makes identifying this particular UFO so challenging is that the Channel 4 interview was most likely shot in front of a green screen, with the London video backdrop digitally added to the video, meaning that the London scene with the UFO zooming through the frame was pre-recorded. And unless the television station knows exactly when the London scene was recorded, the option of contacting local air traffic controllers to see if there was any aircraft in the sky at that particular time, you don't have that luxury. But again, the object is most likely a bird.
It goes so fast, it's hard to tell. It's a neat video, that's for sure. But if it is something mundane, it'd probably be a bird, you know, diving because
it's
moving
down. It looks
like
it's dive bombing. Yeah, it's kind of cruising. It's not flapping at all.
Right. So. It's just kind of diving, right?
Yeah.
Unless it's something else.
And it certainly could be.
Yeah.
We have no idea what it is.
Who knows?
No idea.
Well,
I've got an idea,
sure.
But yeah, we don't know. And another UFO on video, or UFOs, multiple UFOs, in the sky near Stansted Airport in Essex, England, were captured on video by a motorist on his way to London. The incident allegedly occurred on July 29th, just 5 days before BBC journalist Mike Sewell reported a flying disc in the same area. The UFOs in the video are bright orbs with white light that shoot through the sky above the M11 motorway at tremendous speeds. And according to The Sun, former Ministry of Defense UFO researcher and UFO expert Nick Pope said, "Assuming it's genuine, it's one of the most bizarre pieces of UFO footage I've seen in a long time." And I'm going to interrupt here and say, I question whether or not they actually checked with Nick Pope on this. I think they went through their stock Nick Pope quotes, because I'm pretty sure that he said that a couple months ago about a similar video. Or not
really?
A similar video, but about a video. Because I know I've seen that quote before from Nick Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun is sometimes questionable.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, while the orbs of light seen in this video can easily be created with video effect software, it doesn't necessarily mean that this particular video is a hoax. But something else that sends up red flags with this video is the audio in the video. Because if you listen to it, if you watch the video and listen with headphones on, you can tell that the audio in the left and right channels are completely different audio tracks. In the left channel, I believe, you hear music, which supposedly is coming from the car's stereo, but you don't hear anything else. It's just music. And in the right track, you hear the people in the car, a man and a woman, freaking out about it. Oh, mm-hmm. But you don't hear any music.
Is there any chance the music was like a music overlay for effect? Or is it definitely attempting to seem like music from the radio?
It's certainly not background audio that you'd put in unless mm-hmm. you did it really crappily, because it sounds like there's ambient noise.
Yeah.
And the vocal tracks, there's a lot of, I don't know, it seems like there's a lot of reverb, like they're in a room or something, and kind of overacted. So, I don't know. It's very suspicious.
Yeah, that's very suspicious. You know, those are good points, and you've worked in the music industry, and so that's why the International Business Times quoted you as an expert.
It's a quotable opinion.
Yeah.
Well, Alejandro, that is all the news I have for today. Everyone, remember to check out all these stories we talked about and many, many more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm Jason McClellan, your UFO news guy, and I have just briefed you. Back to you, Alejandro.
Thank you, UFO news dude.
Do you like dude or do you like guy?
I like guy. I like dude. Correspondent we use often.
I guess it depends on your mood and how much I've irritated you throughout the day.
And variety is good anyway.
Absolutely. Well, continue with the variety, my friend.
All right. Thank you very much, dude, guy, correspondent. All right, some of the other stories that we have up here on the site. We did cover one of the more spectacular UK UFO files cases that's in there. Now, this is a case that we've known about for quite some time, and in fact, the witness, Ray Bauer, was a pilot, and in April 23, 2007, he was flying. He kind of flies around these islands, the Channel Islands, which are in the English Channel. I had to add that because us Americans aren't as familiar with the area out there. So he's an island hopper, and actually one time he was flying around in April 23rd, and he saw an object that was above these clouds because there was some low-laying haze. And he at first thought it was maybe a building glinting light through the clouds, and he thought, well, that's not possible because there is not light getting to the ground. So he checked it out in his binoculars, and it was this huge cigar-shaped object, yellow, glowing, with a little band of darkness on the right-hand side. Then he noticed one behind it. At first, he thought maybe it was the size of a 737. Later on, though, thinking about it, and then with the radar information, he deducted that this thing must have been maybe even a mile wide. And that's right, you heard me correctly, radar information. Because radars from the ground did pick up this object, and they confirmed that with him while he was in the air asking the tower what was going on and if they had seen this thing. Well, they told him that the object they were picking up was past the island that he was going to land on. So he was happy about that because he was getting worried because as they got closer, of course, they could see these things were bigger and bigger. But he was able to land before they got to the objects because he didn't really want to fly near them, and he had a crew full of cabin full of passengers. But he says the passengers started getting scared, that he can hear them saying, "What is that? Oh, my gosh." You know, and when they got to the ground, he asked them, "What did you see?" And they described the same thing to him that he had seen. And in fact, some of them even talked to the media. So pretty good case. Then a couple days later, he found out when he talked to the tower that there was another plane that had also seen these UFOs that was up there. So this plane was flying, doing the same thing from island to island, and they heard the radar tower say they had gotten an unknown on radar. And so he looked to see if he could view this thing also, and he did. Now, he only viewed it for a minute because it was at a different angle, and then he went behind some clouds and couldn't see it anymore. But he described the same thing, a large cigar-shaped object that was glowing and yellow. So two pilots, radar, passengers all saw this thing, and Dr. David Clark, who is one of the people who helps the UK National Archives with these files, and he writes about UFOs and things, he even talked about how this is one of the most mysterious cases that the UK has on file. The pilot, Ray Brower, actually spoke a few months later in November of 2007 at the Washington National Press Club with an event that was put together by Leslie Keen and James Fox for his documentary Out of the Blue, and where they had gotten a lot of people together, some generals, commanders. They had General DeBauer there. They had General Bermudez from Chile there. This is the same General Bermudez, by the way, who's going to be at the UFO Congress this year. He is running the Chile UFO Study Group, official Air Force UFO group in Chile. So he's going to be at our conference to talk about that. But they had a lot of great people together to talk about UFOs, and Ray Brower was one of those witnesses. So it's a really good case. So I wrote more details about that because these UK UFO files had the official forms, signing forms that were filled out by the witnesses. So you can see their drawings of what they saw and everything. And you can see the official response. And essentially, the UK said, well, that wasn't the primary radar, so they might not have actually gotten it on radar. Either way, the object seemed to be in French airspace and not British airspace, so it's not really our problem. Of course, they didn't say it in those words, but close to it, you can see their exact wording in the file in the article section. So that was another UK UFO story that we covered. All of those stories that Jason talked about, you can also see in the new video that we put up with other cases and other statements that are very credible on the UK files. So very interesting files. However, let us get to our guest today because this is a great one. We have, like I said before, Dr. Claude Swanson, a physicist, and he is... You know what? Let me see if I have here where he got his degrees, because MIT and Princeton, see? Pretty cool stuff. This guy really knows what he's talking about, and I think he's just so terribly interesting. So let's get him on the phone.
I am very happy to be talking once again to my good friend, Claude Swanson. Claude, are you on the phone?
I am. Hi, Alejandro.
Hello. So it sounds like you never take a break. You just finished your gigantic second book, and gigantic in words, but in size. I mean, it's like a larger than normal. It's kind of, 8.5 by 11 almost, and thick.
720 pages.
Yeah.
1,500 references.
Wow.
450 figures. When I was on the George Norrie show, he said they brought it upstairs to him in a forklift.
Yeah, it's definitely a big one. But I remember how long you've been working on it.
It took about 7 years. What happened, you know, my first book was Synchronized Universe, New Science of the Paranormal. And I was really interested in trying to look at phenomena that don't fit our current science. Mm-hmm. Things that really current science cannot explain. And sometimes people put forward theories that they might claim explain them, but they really don't. So I wanted to look at the real evidence in the first book for out-of-body experiences and remote viewing and ESP and psychokinesis and, near-death experiences, levitation, things like that. and first of all say, well, what's the hard evidence? Is it persuasive these things are real? And I concluded, yes, they are real. And in the last chapter of the book, I proposed the outline of a theory for how we could change our current science to begin to account for those things. And that was the synchronized universe model that gave rise to the book and the website. And really, that leads very naturally to the idea of parallel dimensions, parallel realities, and it explains how things can travel faster than light, how they can pass through walls. All the strange things that you see in the UFO cases are also all in the same category as paranormal phenomena, so the same theory applies to both. So that was pretty cool. And then the second book is trying to go deeper and say, well, what is the force that shows up? What makes it possible for the physics to be different in paranormal cases and UFO cases? And what I concluded there is it's what the Chinese call qi. It's the life force, and it's been known for thousands of years, but it's not part of Western science. So I pulled together all the hard evidence I find for how this force behaves, and then tried to develop a theory, at least an outline of a theory, for how we can expand our current science to include qi and include the strange things that you see in energy medicine, energy healing, psychic phenomena, and UFO cases. So it just took that long. And what was surprising to me, Alejandro, is that I discovered there are a whole lot of pieces of the puzzle that I did not know were so far along. Things like the acupuncture meridians of the body have been photographed. They've been proven. The biophoton work in Germany. A lot of different pieces of the puzzle for a newer understanding of how we live, what a living being really is. There's a holographic matrix of energy that determines how we grow, how we heal, and it's also essential in how we communicate, how ESP is possible, things like that. So it ended up being a big book because there are a lot of new discoveries that I put in the book.
It's interesting, you know, you bring in the ancient stuff because it seems as though there are other scientists, and especially people like yourself, theoretical physicists, who are starting to learn that the more sophisticated our understanding of science and how the world works, the more how the ancient and some of these indigenous and Asian, old Asian type of cultures and ways start to make sense. And they start to be able to be explained by this new science.
Well, you know, our Western medicine is very dependent on chemistry and drugs and surgery and processes that are fairly harsh to the body. I mean, cutting and sewing and things like that, and chemicals that are not natural to the body. When you ask yourself, well, how do other societies manage the process of health maintenance and healing? They have a different method. The older societies, in many, many cultures around the world, the Kahunas of Hawaii, the indigenous peoples of Siberia and Russia, Native Americans, so many places have shaman or some equivalent of a shaman who does spiritual practices and energy medicine practices. And some of those work just great. And then, and now in America, you know, we're seeing the fruits of the way we live, of eating too much food, not enough exercise, too much sugar, too much caffeine, too much stress. And it's starting to have effects on our body that Western medicine is not able to handle very well. And some of these more traditional, older-fashioned techniques are actually quite good at it. If you look at the Chinese, for example, their medicine is 4,000 years old. Their medicine was codified by the so-called Yellow Emperor, Wang Di, several thousand years ago, and they put together the principles, and the basic idea is that we are a balance of energies in the body. Those energies govern how we grow, how we heal. When we're in health, we have to have a balance of these different yin and yang, the different forces of energy. And the job of the physician is to keep you well, not to heal you when you get sick, although that's part of it, but if you stay in balance, then you don't get sick. And that's a revolutionary idea for us.
Right.
So we have a lot to learn, from those societies.
Well, you know, I thought, I at one point, for relaxation and things like that, I really got into meditation for a while. And when I really found, mostly partially because, just like a lot of us, I was an emotional storm, you know, I was like, I shouldn't be getting so upset and so emotional about all these things that I get upset about because it's silly. And so I wanted to calm myself. So I got into meditation. And over time, and I thought there's no way I'm going to be able, most people feel this way. There's no way I can silence myself and balance myself. But I figured, you know what, at least even if I take little baby steps, it's better than nothing. Over time, I did find that I could, it's kind of exponential, I could balance myself. And then I discovered that I was getting sick less. And when I would get sick, I would meditate, which is essentially just relaxing, teaching yourself how to relax. And I would get over those sicknesses. And I tell people at work and they kind of laugh and tease me, but they see that it's true. I mean, I don't get sick. And if I do, I'm able to chill out and get rid of it really quick. And it's a simple act of chilling out. And then I learned that, you know, this isn't such a strange idea, even to some physicists and some therapists out there and biologists who are talking about, yeah, the stress is what's really making us sick.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is being learned about the body, you know, and I talk about this in the book Life Force, is the mechanisms the body uses to heal and to make these repairs. The whole acupuncture system of the body is actually a network of tubules that have recently been discovered, recently been photographed. Of course, you know, this is the tradition in Chinese medicine for thousands of years, but in the last few years, they've been traced to a whole new circulatory system, independent of blood, independent of nerves, independent of all the other systems of the body. It's not included in the Western anatomy books. I have a daughter who just got her biology degree at University of Virginia a couple of years ago. She's working on a PhD. She didn't believe that acupuncture meridians existed. I showed her photographs. You know, and in China and in Korea, they've done a lot of hard research to show that these meridians carry signals throughout the body to tell the DNA what kind of pattern it's supposed to be making. So it carries information about what your liver is supposed to look like, how the DNA in your fingernail is supposed to make a certain kind of tissue, while the DNA in some other part of the body makes some other kind of tissue. It's a communication system that actually carries holographic information. It's like a 3D pictorial kind of pattern information that's carried in the acupuncture system. When it's not working right, the signals get messed up a little bit. You get a little, not quite enough of a certain frequency. You get an illness of a certain kind. What they find is that in the acupuncture meridians are also certain kinds of cells, which are called stem cells, which can actually turn themselves into the right kind of tissue that's needed. So if your liver or your skin or something else has an injury, the acupuncture meridian can carry cells to that point. So this energy, this qi, also appears to be essential to understanding ESP and psychic phenomena. And it may explain how craft can travel faster than light as well. So it may have a lot of interesting clues to a better understanding of some of the puzzling phenomena that right now we can't really explain.
So qi, or this energy then, is how does the human body relate to that? I mean, is this energy generated by us somehow? Does it have to do with electromagnetic forces or something? What do you think?
Well, it looks some of the most interesting work has been done in Russia, starting in the 1950s. A man named Nikolai Kozarev, he called it torsion, but it's the same energy, and they all acknowledge this now. The Russians would say it's essentially caused by spin. Every elementary particle, like electrons, protons, neutrons, they all have a spin. They all spin around some axis in the same way the Earth spins around the North Pole. They all have a spin axis. Now, when that spin axis changes, they say that creates a torsion wave. And so this is an elementary kind of force that actually propagates through space and carries that spinning property with it. And there's a left-handed and a right-handed version of this energy. The same as with Chinese medicine, there's a yin and a yang, two different polarities of spin, and they carry opposite qualities. So a whole physics appears to have been worked out by the Russians for how this force behaves. And when glasnost and perestroika happened in the early 90s, and the Russian Empire dissolved, and they released a lot of their client states, the scientists who were working on this suddenly found that they were now permitted to publish their papers, and they also discovered they had no funding anymore. So there was a flood of papers that came out of Russia during that time period about this subject. It is the primary bulk of research we have available today in the West to deal with, but it does point to a hard science that seems to underline this force.
And how did that science then get lost? Because really, it seems it did get lost because we're not using it today.
Well, I think any new science takes time to get accepted. There are always, you can read Thomas Kuhn's, Structure of Scientific Revolution, or you can just look back in history, look at what happened to Galileo when he discovered gravity and some of the early laws of gravity. There were other groups that had their own opinions. The church followed Aristotle. Aristotle had told them a different set of rules. When Galileo came along, they suppressed it. They didn't want Galileo's new theory. They felt that it was a sacrilege. And they asked him, do you want to publish your theory? And if you do, you get the rack. You get a choice here. And he chose not to take the rack and to recant. And, so it's always been a challenge when new ideas come along. In Western science, we have, millions of people going to school learning the Western standard physics. When I was in college, you take the standard E&M course, you learn the theory, then you go into the lab and you do the experiments, and they come out just the way the textbook said they would. Okay? Well, of course, you're doing the experiments the textbook told you to make. They're not looking at other strange things like spins or things like that, so you don't see anything anomalous. And most physicists believe that's the whole story. In fact, the torsion force, it's kind of weak. It's much weaker than electromagnetism, and it often is masked by other effects like temperature, so it's a little bit hard to see. But in Russia, it appears as though a very serious research program, government-supported, went on for several decades, and there are some papers that I talk about in my book, and I describe the experiments with some care, that are sort of me the primary building block, the primary foundation for this new science. And one of the interesting things about this force is, I'll give you an example of an experiment the Russians did. They found that a lot of different materials respond to this force, weakly, but enough so you can use it. And they made a little detector for torsion, and they used tungsten resistors in what's called a Wheatstone bridge, and they could detect torsion very weakly. You put this at the focus of a telescope and aim it at the sun. When the sun goes overhead, even when you block out all the light, all the heat energy and everything else, they found that there was still something coming from the sun. And they were able to see it with this telescope. The interesting thing about their experiment is they didn't see the sun at just one place in the sky. When we look up at the sky, we're looking with our visible optical, you know, sensors, our eyes, we see the sun at a certain place in the sky. It's where it was about 8.3 minutes ago when the light left the sun and traveled toward the Earth. Okay? We're used to that. That's the delayed effect, and that's where the sun appears to us in the sky. What the Russians saw is three places in the sky where the sun appeared when looked at through torsion. There's the delayed, or the what's called the retarded position, which is the normal way we see the sun. They also saw another position, which corresponds to a signal that traveled at infinite speed. There was no time delay in the second signal.
Wow.
They also saw a third signal, which is where the sun would be if light traveled backwards in time or left the telescope, went to the sun. So that's a really strange one. They saw these three spots in the sky.
Now, the third spot, I don't quite get you there. At backward in time. Oh, as if the light. So in other words, the same distance as the retarded one from the actual, but in back in time.
Yeah, so the central point is the instantaneous point.
Gotcha.
Then the one, the retarded, or the normal one, we would say, is on one side of that, and the advanced one is on the other side of that.
Gotcha. Wow, that's very strange.
So it says that this torsion signal is unusual in that it has elements that travel faster than light, and in fact, so they go backwards in time. So it's a really strange course, but the neat thing is that it's right in with what people see in psychic phenomena. There are experiments, for example, well, we'll take remote viewing, for example. In remote viewing, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to see a target that's in the past or in the future or in the present. Thomas Monagle says his accuracy is 65 to 80% for all three, the past, present, and future targets. When I took the Farsight courses in remote viewing, we would look at targets 65 million years ago, the destruction of the dinosaurs. And, you know, we got quite good results in terms of, I saw something, a fireball of something coming out of the sky, and it's all these little figures looking up at it. And the whole thing, I was able to name the target. In remote viewing, you're never told what the target is. It's a psychic process, but it's a systematic process that makes it easier to do because you get your conscious mind out of the way. And so it's an example where time doesn't matter. The Princeton Pear Lab, for 30 years, conducted hundreds of thousands of experiments on psychic phenomena, ESP, psychokinesis, things like that, and they found that time doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So you can send or receive the signal backward or forward in time, which is totally unlike the forces of physics that we're used to. But it's very much like the way torsion behaves. So it may have the answer to what the force is that explains paranormal phenomena.
So do you believe that we perhaps have our sixth sense would be a sense of torsion, and somehow we're using torsion to be able to be psychic?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, experiments have been done with people, just average people. You put them in a lab, you wire up the brains, the brain waves, the EEG measurement, and you send them a psychic message. Well, first of all, they'll do an experiment, like they'll play a tone, like a musical note, and they'll watch how the brain waves respond. Then they'll send a psychic message. Now, the person's in a isolation booth, has no idea that someone's trying to send a psychic message. But the brain waves respond much the same way as when you hear a tone. In other words, the brain waves basically say, I'm getting a signal. Okay? Now, consciously, The person has no idea he's getting a signal, but his brainwaves are showing that at the subconscious level, he received a psychic message. So we probably all have the reception machinery built into us, and what's really the problem for most people is our conscious minds are chattering all the time. We're always, we learn in school, left brain processes, memorization, adding, subtracting, things like that, analyzing. The trick is to quiet that part of the mind. That's where meditation comes in. That's where hypnosis can be helpful. When you quiet that chattering mind, then you can start to listen to those messages that the subconscious is receiving. So I think we all have the machinery.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so you talked about how they were able to measure torsion with a device. If torsion, I know with Wilhelm Reich, for instance, he used devices. He believed he could create orgone and what he, you know, his version of the chi. Then can electronic devices, could we build them? Could we build like a torsion TV where we can tune into some of this stuff?
We might. We might be able to. I can't say we can until we do, but what I describe in the book, I have a couple of chapters on the torsion science and on devices that have been built, which they claim work for communication. We're sending signals through waveguides or broadcast through the air, and you know, they penetrate materials that would reflect electromagnetic signals, and they travel a lot faster potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we're talking about the very early stages of a new science. It's like we're talking to Michael Faraday, you know, back when he just invented electricity or just discovered how electromagnet worked, even before Maxwell came along with his equations.
Mm-hmm.
And you're asking him, well, you know, what good is it? What could you do with it? Well, it turns out a member of Parliament did ask Faraday that exact question: what good is electricity? 1850. What good is it? And Faraday's answer was, well, sir, someday you will be able to tax it.
Taxing torsion.
So we're at the early stages here, but I would not be surprised if there are many amazing developments along the way.
With the communication device that was built, was it then able to communicate faster than any sort of radio wave, like an instantaneous type of communication?
That is what the fragmentary papers and reports that we have from the Russians indicate.
Mm-hmm.
That yes, it will be able to travel faster than light. There's not a lot of detail on a lot of this stuff, or if there is, it's in Russian and there's not been translated. So what we have is the tip of the iceberg, but that's what it looks like. Yeah.
Now, are there any labs out there working on torsion now that you know of?
I don't know of it. I don't know about it if there are. I would imagine so. It seems foolish to overlook it,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know about any. The government, as far as I know, the National Science Foundation, they don't give grants to do research on it. So in America, it's been pretty much poo-pooed in mainstream science. There were a couple of Russians, not Russian scientists, but a couple of Russians who wrote articles on the web that debunked it. And in public American science, it seems like it's kind of been decided that, oh, it's just a bunch of hooey and just don't even touch it, you know. But if you start looking into it, there are an enormous number of Russian scientists that worked on this for decades.
Wow.
In fact, if you go back to the classic book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain by Ostrander and Schroeder, that was written in 1970. It came out in 1970, before, it was 40 years ago. And they interviewed this man, Nikolai Kosarev, who discovered torsion in the 50s. So in the late 60s, when they are over there, they're in his lab. They're in his lab at an observatory in Russia. And he's doing these experiments right in front of them and showing them how these things work. And they're describing it, and it's the most amazing thing. You know, there's no chance that this was, you know, somebody trying to mislead anybody. You know, So the probabilities are this is a genuine, real science, and it's a real phenomenon, and it's hard to believe it's not being researched somewhere.
So, yeah, if I can get the money, would you help me? We'll open up Swanson Torsion Labs and get this whole thing running.
Well, let's talk about that offline.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I mean, it seems like something that needs to be picked up. And for, as far as, let's see, with this sort of torsion, it's similar to Qi, you had said. And I know you had talked about different Chinese experiments that they had done that were pretty advanced and had some incredible results.
That was one of the things that got me involved in the first place, because I met an energy healer back in the 80s, Mitek Virkus, who was a Polish immigrant who was quite gifted at energy healing. And up until that time, my impression about most of these strange phenomena is that they're very elusive. They come and they go, and they're not very reliable. And so it's hard to do research on them because they're so weak. But Mitek was an energy healer who, when he worked on you, you could feel the energy. You know, he never touched anybody. He was always several feet away, but you felt, you know, you felt a shift. You felt something better and more energetic and healthier and happier after he worked on you. And one thing I noticed is that he would breathe. He would breathe in a funny kind of way, inhaling and exhaling his breath. The Hindus call this pranayama. It's a yogic method of breathing. And what they say is you're building up qi in your body. You have a concentration of qi, and that's what gives you the ability to do these things. So that was, I guess, maybe the origin of some of this research. What the Chinese have been doing in the recent years is studying these masters scientifically. They've discovered that some of these, they call them qigong masters. They build up qi in their body. They can move it around. They can project it out of the acupuncture points. Often they use the hand as a place where they would emit this qi, and they can send it to somebody else. And you can feel it when it lands, when it hits you. It's a form of healing. It's also used in some forms of martial arts. So what the Chinese government has been doing is doing research scientifically in the lab with some of these people to see what happens, what are the effects of qi and how it behaves. There was one great master, I think he's still alive, Dr. Yan Jin, who in the 1980s began research with the scientific, the physics, National Physics Institute in China, and they did a series of experiments with them. They would do things like you have a radioactive material like americium, which gives off alpha particles periodically. And, you know, for materials that have a long half-life, they decay slowly, and therefore we watch them decay, but it's pretty much just a standard rate. We don't know how to change that rate of decay very much. But they would ask this Qigong master, can you affect how fast it decays? And he would say, okay, well, see if you could increase it. And he would increase it, and it would go up maybe 10-20% faster decay. They would say, okay, now see if you can decrease the decay. It would decrease several percent. And he'd say, okay, now let's see how distance factors in. And he would go away from the experiment by 1,000 miles.
Wow.
He would ask him to do the same thing, and it would still work. Okay.
That's pretty amazing.
They did the same type of experiment with laser beams, bending lasers. You can change the structure of water. This is one thing many healers are able to do by sending their qi energy into the water. It changes the water bonding between the hydrogen and oxygen atoms of the molecule. You can measure this on a certain type of lab procedure called Raman spectroscopy. Will show you how the bonding has changed from the qi. So lots of experiments have been done, and China's been one of the leaders. They've also shown that you heal from cancer surgery and things like that faster after Qigong, after receiving a dose of Qi. Mm-hmm. So lots of interesting stuff going on. And in my book, presents all of that material.
So would it be accurate to say then, because I know this word is misused a lot, but because you talk about Qi or this energy, for lack of a better word, I guess I'll just call it Qi, has to do with spin and at a very small level. Would it be accurate then to call it, using kind of a modern vernacular, a quantum type of energy?
Well, my suspicion is that it goes below that. It goes beneath that. Our quantum physics is the accepted standard physics.
Mm-hmm.
And we say this is the uncertainty principle that limits how finely processes can be talked about, how finely you can look at processes. But most quantum phenomena, deals with things on the size of the atom or the size of the nucleus, basically elementary particles that we're familiar with. Those go down as small as 10 to the minus 15 meters. The width of a nucleus is 10 to the minus 15 meters, which is called one Fermi. That's kind of the smallest scale of most quantum things that are talked about. But there is a frontier now looking at things at a deeper level. One kind of research has been worked on by Hal Puthoff, Bernie Haish, Alphonse Rueda, and others, where they try to go deeper. And they say, well, why does quantum physics work the way it does? Is there some mechanism at a deeper level? And that's what Einstein always mm-hmm. believed. That was the problem he had with Bohr and all the quantum debate. He thought quantum physics is okay, but it's only an approximation. There's something at a deeper level. Well, what these people are presented is if you assume that the vacuum is filled with energy, with lots of photons and other things floating around, that a particle that we say is just in a quantum state, it's just sitting there, sitting still, not doing anything, we say it's in a stable energy state. And that would be most things, like an atom sitting in space, a hydrogen atom, for example, sits in space in a quantum picture. It's not doing anything. It's in a stable quantum state, and we just say it's in an eigenstate. You don't have to worry about it, and that's what you learn in school. But in the picture that the other gentleman has developed, it's a dynamic system. It's radiating energy out into space all the time. It's being hit by the energy in the vacuum, which is exciting it and causing it to bounce around. That's where the uncertainty principle comes from. So it's an interplay between energy coming in and energy going out. So it's a deeper, more detailed description. And that's where this torsion picture seems to fit.
Mm-hmm.
Torsion appears to be maybe the finest scale energy in the vacuum. It may even sort of define the fabric of space-time.
So that's sub-quantum.
It's sub-quantum, exactly. And so if you want to do things that go beyond our current physics, you have to go there, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we think that Einstein's equations, well, it's about space and time. But suppose this other force, this chi force, is able to change space and time. Suppose you can distort. You can speed up or slow down time. Mm-hmm. Suppose you can stretch things in ways our current physics can. This chi force may hold the answer to how to do that. So that's the exciting thing for me. Because some of these experiments that you look at, these Qigong masters, they defy current physics.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be able to explain them by sticking with current physics.
It's exciting, too, because there's so many disciplines that are talking about different parts. So, for example, you're talking about healing and the ways to heal and this chi being able to balance at a sub-quantum level your atoms and your cells. There's a gentleman, and I know you know of him and his work, and His name is kind of Bob Plimpton or Pilkington, or he's a biologist who talks about, and he makes it so you can understand because he was a teacher of biology, how cells respond better to other types of energy than chemicals, which is what we deal with them with. And which for him allows this idea of also the healing and the energy healing, and light healing, the things like people do, putting lights on cells and things like that. You know who I'm talking about? Plimpton? Is that his name?
I don't know. The name, okay. The name sounds familiar, but I don't recognize him.
Uh-huh.
But sort of that type of thing is being demonstrated over and over again now at the frontiers of medicine and in alternative medicine. A lot of healing going on with lights and certain frequencies. I mean, the work started, in 1970 in Germany with Fritz Albert Popp, who got the idea that DNA as a big molecule creates and absorbs photons, little packets of energy, and that it sends those packets to other molecules in the cell, and those packets contain both energy and information and cause other molecules to respond in a certain way. So it's a whole communication system. And he began working on this idea back in 1970. Everybody else laughed at it. They thought he was crazy. Now 30, 40 years later, it's a huge body of work German groups have amassed to show it's not crazy. It's actually the way the living systems work.
Yeah,
So frequencies of light are an important part of that.
Right. I was going to mention, I saw a documentary recently on Swedish working on Tibetan medicines, because the Tibetans talked about the light body. When they worked on a body, they worked on the light body, and that their herbal remedies were just that, were centered around that, the light frequency, which is really interesting. And I guess the Swedish worked on it and have created pills that are similar to Tibetan medicine that are helpful. But unfortunately, especially in the United States and other countries, they don't accept that form of medicine.
Well, again, we have in this country and in other countries too, there's already an industry, an entrenched industry, if you excuse the expression, that is quite happy with the profits they're making and the technology they have. And so partly there's resistance to learning something new, but partly it's competition.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about technology that could put out of business some of these patents and drugs and things like that. So, of course, they're against it. So it's hard. It's never just strictly science. It's always the business aspect and the emotional aspect as well. So, that's why it takes time. New discoveries take time to work their way into the system.
Yeah. Thinking of that term subquantum, which is a really neat term. I love Star Trek, and it sounds like a Star Trek-y type of thing. Then how does this all translate over to kind of UFOs and being able to move faster than light?
Well, if you go back to the Russian experiments with the sunlight, they were actually seeing a component of energy, two different components, one going backwards in time, and then the one going infinite speed, which is faster than light. So those two out of the three signals they were seeing do go faster than light, and they were based on this torsion.
So infinite speed, using that term, which was meaning that probably as fast as is possible.
Well,
is
I don't
that
know.
What you mean by infinite speed?
Infinite speed means it takes no time to get from point A to point B.
Okay.
Zero time. But, the Russian measurements with the sunlight were indicating there's a third signal going backwards in time.
Right.
Would you call that faster than infinite?
Right.
You might, we're in a strange new regime here where people will have to go over this and rethink a lot of the concepts we've taken for granted. Like, what is the fastest speed? How do we rework our physics to include some of these things. And So we're at the early stages right now, but certainly if you want to have a chance of going faster than light, then you might think that particles, or whatever version you want to call it, you call it a wave, it's a signal, maybe a quantum signal, but that might be a good place to start. So, you know, I don't have all the answers right now, but it's a promising technology.
We need you to get those answers as soon as possible.
Yes, sir. Right to it.
Yeah. Well, that's right, which is why we experiment and why they experiment, of course, with the quantum particles, because they're able to demonstrate some faster than light, which if we understand how the mechanics of that, then that may allow us to build a machine or some sort of process to exceed the speed of light.
Well, one of the things that some of the Russian torsion scientists claim to have done is to use torsion generators to change the rate of time. It's like a primitive version of a time machine. I mean, not really, in the sense that you're not jumping to different times, but you're speeding up or slowing down time. These two different components of torsion, the right-handed and left-handed torsion, appear to have opposite effects on the rate of time. So you can fill a volume of space with one or the other form of torsion, and you can speed up or slow down time. And there have been several papers about that. Put a watch or a clock in the middle of the space, an equal, identical clock outside, and then let them run for a while and then see where they are. And the one inside may run slower or faster, depending on the kind of torsion you're filling the space with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty interesting experiment that might have applications.
Yeah, that would help you with your book. You would be able to slow down time to where it feels like a long period has passed and you can finish your book in a day.
I could really use that. That would be very useful.
That's what I would do, write 10 stories in a day.
Sometimes it seems to work the other way, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it sounds good.
With this, then, subquantum energy, it also kind of fits the Qi idea and other, of course, indigenous people talking about this energy being in everything, even Star Wars and the Force, but which then would does that – have there been experiments with actually trying to – you said they were affecting that radioactive material, but what about moving things? What about what is that, telekinesis?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I've seen any good experiments. I know, you know, the most famous telekinesis experiments are the Princeton Pear Lab experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And they are on a much smaller scale, not as spectacular as Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, knocking over, you know, some robot or something.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Princeton Pear Lab, they have little quantum devices. Basically, they're called random event generators. And they use quantum noise and electrons to create a stream of ones and zeros that are random. They're equivalent to flipping a coin very fast and counting your heads and your tails, you know, keeping track of them. And on the average, you'll get a balance, you know, equal numbers of heads and tails. But if you ask someone to make it go high, to get more heads and tails or more ones and zeros, the Princeton Pear Lab found that virtually anybody was able to do it. And, of course, some people are better than others. But what's remarkable is that it doesn't matter how far away you go. If you put these people 1,000 miles from the random event generator, and they were just as good at making it go high or low when requested.
Hmm.
So that's a really simple form of telekinesis. Not very impressive, maybe, because you have to process it by computer. But you get a very high statistical accuracy. And you know, to convince scientists that you're really looking at a simple noise and odds against chance. Because a skeptical scientist would say, okay, yeah, you got it to go the way you tried, you wanted it to do that time, and can you do it again? And that's where they come in, and that's a very reasonable question. What the Princeton Pear Lab found was, yes, do it again and again and again, and the odds against chance, the odds that these are real effects and not due to random fluctuations, because now that Parallab has done so much data, we're talking about odds against chance of trillions to one. Trillions to one that this is a real effect, not a chance effect. So it's overwhelming that they've demonstrated that PK exists. Now, some of the Chinese masters, other people who study this stuff their whole lives, develop amazing abilities. If you read the wonderful book by the Indian yogi, Yogananda, he talks about growing up as a yogi and the things he witnessed. There are some amazing things in there. The Chinese have been researching some of their masters. They did a search in the 1980s to find some of the people who were most able to create paranormal phenomena. I talk about that in Volume 1. One of the people was named Zhang Baozheng. He was famous for teleportation. The VIP visitors would come over to come to their site, and he would cause a 100-pound sack of sugar to teleport through a wall.
Wow.
And people could just sit there and watch it. And then the other experiments they would do with a radio transmitter. We would teleport it from one place to another. They were doing experiments on this stuff in the 70s and 80s, and there are a number of reports from VIP visitors who were treated to shows that they would show some of these people. And so I described some of those in my book, and Paul Dong, who's a Qigong master, has written several books about some of those experiments. So if you look hard and find really able people, you do find them. I'll give you one example. There's a professor in the University of California system who's been doing research on this stuff. He took a course in Qigong from a very powerful master. One day the class was coming out of their lesson onto a sidewalk in Los Angeles, and a woman in the class had her purse snatched by some guy who began running down the street, crowded sidewalk. Then the master came out and saw what happened. And of course, people in the class were all yelling at him, that guy stole her purse. The guy's 40 feet away and running fast as he can. The master looks up and holds out his hand. Just like in Star Wars, holds out his hand and the guy falls down. He falls down and he cannot get up. The class saunters over to him and they pick up the purse, and the master says to this man, "Don't do that again."
Wow.
And I heard this from one of the people in the class, who's a professor in the University of California system, very high integrity, well-known scientist. So, these things do happen if you find individuals who are sufficiently well-trained.
This is the kind of thing that I think is so exciting. And unfortunately, I don't think it's really made it into the mainstream, because what you're talking about are these subtle energies that theoretical physicists, more than just yourself, are starting to open up to, and because they're starting to see that there are these things going on and there have to be other mechanics behind it that we don't understand yet, and we're seeing all these crazy things happen in quantum physics. So like you said, these ideas about these sub-quantum type of energies. And all of this opens up these incredible possibilities that this amazing story you just described could possibly be explained by science if we just understood those subtle energies involved.
Well, that's why my second book, Life Force, The Scientific Basis, is so big, because I have a lot of the experiments in there. I got the graphs, I got the references and everything else. So a scientist could go through that and learn about these experiments. Same way with the first book, Synchronized Universe, I try to put in the data. What's the evidence for these phenomena? Because most Western physicists never hear about these experiments.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know this stuff exists. A lot of them have even been kind of brainwashed to not be interested. They've been told, oh, it's a bunch of hogwash, it's just a bunch of, and so they don't even look open-mindedly or in a serious way to find what the evidence is. So I try to put my books together in a way to, if someone does have the courage to open them and read, they'll see, my God, there's evidence that these things actually happen. Here's how it behaves. And then they'll say, well, hey, we need a better theory. We need a theory for this. And that's what's needed right now is, I belong to an organization called ISSSEEM, which is a subtle energy organization that looks into science and subtle energy. They on three different years, they paid money to some of the top string theorists, people like Brian Greene, Michio Kaku, to come and talk. What they found is that these people know very little about subtle energy. They don't read the journal articles about subtle energy or qi or qigong. So they don't have access to the evidence. So they're working on their theories, assuming that Western physics already knows how the universe behaves. They just have to make a little bit better mathematical theory for it. And the idea there's a whole other force that's been left out of Western physics hasn't occurred to them.
Hmm. On a positive note, too, talking about that ISEEM organization, it seems like there's a lot of them in Boulder. What's up with Boulder? That's where I went to university, actually, because it's just an advanced place, I guess. But, I mean, there's the Life and Mind Institute out there, which is, I know they've gotten really involved with the Dalai Lama, and it's a bunch of scientists, quantum physicists, starting to see similarities. And also an organization you belong to, the Society for Scientific Exploration. And they're a bunch of scientists. I know they're somewhat skeptical about UFOs, although they talk about it. But they're very open to some of these consciousness type of ideas, aren't they?
They are. A lot of these are university professors. People like Robert John at Princeton, who did the Paralab experiments, is one of the founders of that organization. The reason they created the SSE is because they get resistance when they try to publish their papers in the mainstream physics journals. Those journals just say, oh, we don't publish that kind of stuff. We don't want to know about that, and we don't believe in it or whatever. And so they needed a place where people could exchange information and talk about this. And the SSE is one of those wonderful organizations which is open-minded, has real scientists with good, rigorous training in many cases, and yet they're open-minded to these controversial issues. And UFOs was one of the topics covered in one of the national meetings of the SSE a couple of years ago. So it's very refreshing that at least they provide a forum.
And I think Peter Sturrock started it, right? And he was an astronomer who was very into UFOs, and that was the main impetus, I think, to create something.
Yeah.
So are you then hopeful that that you putting out your books about this and some of these other scientists are getting involved, do you feel that your colleagues in science is starting to move into this area?
Yes, it's a slow process. It happens one at a time. I meet people every day who love my books. They're very grateful for them, including scientists. The numbers, compared to the number of people who you would reach from a national television show like NOVA, it's a tiny fraction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a slow process because the main media still doesn't seem willing to carry these messages. So it's still basically, we are teaching a course now at the California Institute for Human Science, small college in Salinas, California, that's taking my book as a textbook. So energy medicine and these new discoveries, I think they're growing, and the more, I think as Western medicine becomes too expensive, and there's too many, a lot of people just realize they can't afford it or it's not doing a good job, and energy healers can do things that a doctor with a pill, you know, can't do, then that opens up people's minds. They start saying, well, I have a friend who's an energy healer out in Missouri, you know, and he works on people at, you know, thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And they can feel the energy. They feel the benefit from it. But then the next question is, how does that work? How could that possibly happen? How can you explain it? And that's where it's good to have a book like mine, and that's where the science starts to open up. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a slow process.
Yeah. Bruce Lipton, that's the guy who is, I was thinking of the biology of belief, where he talked about that human.
Absolutely.
But I can see the PR problem, though, too, is that it's very technical and it's very difficult. There's not very many scientists. Michio Kaku is one who's good at translating to the layman these complicated scientific ideas. But I think it's so interesting that hopefully if there's any documentary makers out there listening, I think this is definitely something to tackle, because it's worth it. It's demonstrating that there is this slow movement to this, and the benefits are incredible, because if extraterrestrials, civilizations, advanced civilizations out there have mastered these subtle energies, and it demonstrates how they can do things to us that would seem impossible.
There's a famous scientist, a Chinese scientist, I'm not sure I can pronounce his name properly. He immigrated from the U.S. back into mainland China back in the 80s. It was a front page story in Newsweek and Time. He was famous in the U.S. He was one of the founders of Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He went to China and became instrumental in leading their rocketry and space program. He's one of the most distinguished scientists in China, and Aviation Week and Space Technology has lauded, you know, what a great scientist he is. He looked at the, and on my website I have the reference to this quote. He looked at this data, some of these experiments I was mentioning earlier from Dr. Yan Jin, where he changed radioactivity and radioactive decay rates and bending laser beams and things like that with qi. And basically he says, yes, this is real, and it's a genuine breakthrough. It's a revolution. It's a whole new area of physics. You know, this is a frontier that has been opened up with this force and these new experiments. And so it's an exciting time for people who catch on that this stuff is happening. So I think inevitably it's going to gain interest as time goes on.
Yeah, very exciting. And your website is synchronizeduniverse.com. That's where they can get your books and everything and read. You've got a lot of material up there for people to look at and experiment. And you're working on a third book.
Well, yeah, Alejandro, if you can't spell synchronized, because we Americans spell it with a Z, while the English, I think, use an S.
Right.
So all you have to do is put my name, Claude Swanson, into Google, and the website pops up, you know, near the top of the list.
Yeah.
That's an easy way to find the website.
That's the way people do it these days anyway. I know a lot of people, they don't even have the URL bar because they just Google it. So Claude Swanson, Google Claude Swanson. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
All right. Great. Thank you so much. You also have some lectures that you do around and other radio shows, and they can get all of that information. But I've had the pleasure of knowing you for quite some time and got to spend time. I knew you before you moved, knew of you, I should say, before you moved to Colorado. So it was great to get to know you when you did move out to Colorado. And it's always great to talk to you. So thank you so much for joining the radio show.
Thank you, Alejandro. Talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Always wonderful to talk to Claude Swanson. Next week, because we only got a few seconds, we've got Lee Spiegel from the Huffington Post, the guy who's been writing about UFOs and stuff. Cool guy. He's the one who helped me get my blog over there. So I'm very excited to talk to him. So join us next week. Talk to you later, people.